fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Awe for the incredible power of Mother Nature and a fascination with the weather is something many of us have in common. The weather has an enormous influence in our lives, from our wardrobe to our weekend plans. People, businesses, and local government officials rely on accurate and detailed forecasts in a variety of ways. They help emergency managers warn the public ahead of a tornado or severe storm, help farmers manage and protect their crops. They aid local officials as they prepare for an approaching winter storm and assist families planning activities around potential rainfall. But where do those weather forecasts and warnings come from? And what's the science behind them? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Today, we explore the world of weather forecasting with tips and tools to help you create your own weather predictions right in your own backyard. Throughout the program, we invite you to join the conversation and ask your own questions by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email questions to ideas at WPR.org. Professional meteorologists spend their days looking at weather conditions. They analyze a variety of prediction models and use their knowledge and experience to interpret data to communicate their forecasts and critical warnings to the public. And every forecast or warning you receive, whether it's on the internet, TV, radio, or from your favorite app, is the result of more than a century of ongoing discovery, innovation, and collaboration by a dedicated community of thousands around the world. Joining us today is one of those dedicated professionals, WSAW-TV meteorologist Chad Franzen, who is an expert at forecasting the quickly changing weather of Wisconsin. Chad has a master's degree in meteorology from Mississippi State University. He received his American Meteorological Society seal in 1999, has a Doppler radar certification, and also earned the American Meteorological Society's Certified Broadcast Meteorologist designation. It's a professional recognition of the quality of his weather broadcast. Chad, welcome to Route 51.
Good morning. How are you, Shereen?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, absolutely. We first made the call and talked to Joy about coming on. I was looking forward to it on a Friday. I was kind of hoping for some better weather at some point, but we just haven't quite got there yet. But that's what happens. It's Wisconsin.
It's Wisconsin, that's for sure. Blink and you'll miss a weather change, right? Well, every meteorologist I know has a different story about what drew them to this kind of work. I have to wonder, take me back to the moment when you knew that weather was going to be your life, that this was going to be the direction you were going to go.
Well, the funny thing was, is I didn't really, I always was weather and what was going on in the weather community. When I grew up out west in Montana, I was always out in the hills fishing and always thought it was great on how you could go hiking. And the next thing you know, you're hiking and you're in a snowstorm. So I was always fascinated with the weather. But what happened was, is I was going to college for engineering at a school that at South Dakota School of Mines in Rapid City that was all engineering and had two other degrees I could go into at that point. One was paleontology and the other was meteorology. I went and sat with a paleontologist and watched him dust a bone for 8 hours, and I knew that was not my future career, and basically just switched to meteorology, not necessarily knowing what I was getting into. I just knew it was a study of weather and not necessarily rocks. And so that's kind of how it happened for me. And overall, it was just one of those things. I lucked into it. And when I got into graduation mode, the National Weather Service had gone through some huge cutbacks at that point. So I continued on in my education in a school that's better noted for broadcasting. Didn't really think it was ever going to be a reality. And 20-some years later, here I am.
Well, in your bio, I read that you love storm chasing. So tell me about that. What does it feel like to be out there running toward a storm rather than away from it, which is what most of us do?
Well, and that's just it. Storm chasing has really evolved as the technology's evolved. So 15, 20, even 25 years ago, storm chasers, they were kind of a hard breed to come by because you just didn't have a lot of people doing it. This day and age with the technology, everybody's got a cell phone. Everybody's pretty much has a high-speed internet connection on a cell phone. So now you have multiple and many storm chasers. So now it's the whole reason we storm chase is to make sure we know what's going on at the bottom levels of the atmosphere, underneath the cloud deck where the radar really just can't see what's going on. And here in central Wisconsin, we're really in this void between the different National Weather Service radars in Duluth, La Crosse, Minneapolis in some capacity, passing Green Bay. So by the time the radar signal, for instance, gets to the Wausau area, even on the lowest tilt of the radar, you're already about 9,000 feet in the air. So storm chasers are an integral part of severe weather season because they can tell you and show you and can see what's going on underneath the radar beam. So you see the vertical extent of the storm, which we talk about for tornadoes as a hook echo on the radar. That's all great, fine and dandy. Those are typical supercells that happen to make those kind of things show up on the radar. But again, we're seeing it at about 9,000 feet and above, and we don't see what's going on below. And obviously, a tornado forms in that lowest level below that radar beam. So that's really where storm chasing has really kind of been so integral in the point of where the Doppler radar, the WSR 88D, has been out there from the Weather Service for years. But the last couple of years, they have a new part of it called the dual polarization of it. And that dual pole radar helps us determine what kind of structure you have, not only within the storm, but it can also have a tornado signature. And there's actually products made for determining tornado debris. And storm chasers are an integral part of being able to verify that when they see that on the radar. So it's really evolved behind the scenes. But for most people, storm chasing that aren't in it or ever thought of it, it's about what it sounds like. You're going out to try to get a look at the storm, at what's going on underneath the radar beam, and you're going to do it in a safe manner.
Crazy. And you know, you talked about how things have changed because of, you know, so many people have these mobile devices, they're able to weigh in a little bit more. But overall, has forecasting become more accurate over the years? What's changed since maybe from when you started?
Oh, sure. So when I first started, everybody in the weather community, we talk about weather computer modeling, and weather modeling has been out there since the 60s and 70s. So some of the first maps that computers were spitting out were started in these big IBM Cray centers that were the size of big buildings that would run one computer model. Now it's evolved into basically a very fancy version of like a Windows server that can run these computer models. The other thing that has happened is, as the computing power has finally caught up to the technology, is meteorologists and the National Weather Service and NOAA and the Department of Commerce that this all sits under, they have put more money and more effort into making the computer modeling more accurate. And how that happens is you cut down the size of the Earth that you're trying to predict the entire weather pattern for. So, for instance, think of it like a piece of grid paper. They would lay that over the country, and they're trying to predict all the different forecasts in that grid point. Well, in the old days, these grids were hundreds of kilometers in size. Now, in the newer days, we have computer models that run about a 3 kilometer, what we call resolution. So now you can pinpoint predict in areas that are only 3 kilometers apart, basically. And that's where the modeling has gotten so much better. And there's several different models now. Everybody's, we've got a European model, there's a Canadian model, and then there's several American models that have all come to fruition here in the last 10, 15 years. So someone at home may say, well, the forecast has gotten less accurate, or you're wrong. The computer modeling is astronomically better than it ever was, but you're also kind of married to it in a way that when these models are predicting things that are from one model to the next are so far different, that's when the meteorologist steps in and uses their knowledge to determine what part of that model is right, what is wrong, and then go with the forecasting from there. So that's how it's really evolved. It's unbelievable to me in the last 20 years that we went from computers that were running the size of buildings to now you can run several models in one computer rack. The technology has just gotten so much better that it's helped not only the weather industry and meteorology, but all industries. But in our capacity, what I've seen the last 20 years, I never thought I would ever saw.
Well, I want to ask you about some specific things, taking the mystery out of some of these things for me. I'm fascinated with the weather like so many people are, but I don't know really what some of these things are. Like what's a jet stream? What does that have to do with the weather?
Oh, sure. And so the jet stream is the integral part of our weather pattern, not only in the You've got a southern jet in the southern hemisphere and the northern jet in the northern hemisphere, the polar jet. And the jet stream is basically a big wind current that's spinning around the globe that really is steering and controlling a lot of the weather patterns. And so anytime the jet stream in Wisconsin right now, in our area in central Wisconsin, we are the epitome of what the jet stream can do when it sits on top of the state. So when you have the jet stream over Wisconsin, like we have now and will for the better part of the next 5 to 7 days, you can expect storm systems either every day or every other day because you're now in that active storm track. Think of it like a kind of a traffic jam. All the storm systems are coming in. They get into that main flow. You go from, let's say, 4 lanes to 1, and now you're in the 1 lane, and now you have cars every bumper to bumper everywhere. That's what's happening with our storm systems and our jet stream right now in Wisconsin, is all these storm systems are lined up to move right across Wisconsin. That's why we can't get a bright sunny day for the most part, and we have the repeated chances for rain showers and even a few flakes at times at night.
What about the cold front versus the warm front? What do they tell us about the changes in weather?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of things you can determine, cold front, warm front. And people at home will notice this. They may not know the science behind it. That's the fun part of being in the television industry and meteorology, is the education part of it. But when a cold front and warm fronts move through Wisconsin, distinct things happen. Wind directions change, humidity values change, and you always kind of know what kind of a system is approaching your area because of the current wind conditions and also the current cloud cover. So that's the fun part of it. And so for today, for instance, we, for the better part of the last couple of days, we've been anywhere from an east or southeast, east, northeast wind. Those are usually warm fronts coming in that are lifting northward across the Badger State. And so this time of year, especially in this quick moving jet stream, you usually have some kind of a pressure system, in this case, always low pressure. And those systems work in tangent and conjunction with each other. So the warm front's lifting across Wisconsin. We have an actual trailing cold front that's way back in western parts of the Dakotas, and a low pressure system, an upper level low that's sitting over eastern North Dakota. So that's what's affecting our weather now. And then that whole system in tandem will move off to the northeast in the next couple of days. Repeated shower chances. Storm system is actually moving in the storm track, in this case, the jet stream. So it's a big, huge process that's given us our weather right now. And that's also why in long-term weather patterns, it takes things a while to change. Last year, you may remember in April, we had beautiful weather and it was warm, sunny, 70s and 80s. And then we got into that third week of May and we had some areas with frost because the weather pattern hadn't made that full shift. And so this year, we're still in that late winter, early spring type pattern. For the weather nerds, that's the North Atlantic Oscillation. We're still in a negative pattern there. And when it goes to the positive side, that's when we get the typical jet stream from the northwestern part up near Alaska. And then it drives down into the eastern part of the country. So we will make that shift in the next several weeks, but it takes a while. And again, that's all part of the jet stream and how the Earth works.
All right. And can you physically feel it? When you're outside, can you physically feel when a cold front hits or a warm front hits? Or is that something that's up way too high in the sky?
Well, it does extend down to the surface. The thing that you're going to feel, if there's going to be a quick change, anytime you have a quick change, it's always going to be a wind. It's windy conditions from this direction or windy conditions from that. So that's what you're really feeling more of, is the wind, and depending on it, if there's a below 50 degrees, you'd have technically a wind chill. So that's what you're really feeling more than anything else. But think of it on a summer day when we get a couple of days of the hot, humid weather, storms come through, and then the cold front comes through behind it. And most of the time this happens in late night hours, but you'll go from hot and sweaty conditions the day before to maybe not as hot, but certainly a lot less humidity because the cold front brings in the drier dew points.
You're listening to Backyard Meteorology on Route 51 with our guest, Chad Franzen from WSAW-TV. Coming up, separating fact from fiction when it comes to some common weather myths, and we'll answer your questions too when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Programs like this don't just happen. They're made possible by people just like you. Listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR programs. That's important, especially right now during our spring member drive. Make your impact on Route 51 and all WPR programs with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thank you. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Chad Franzen is here today for a discussion on weather forecasting just in time for tornado season in Wisconsin. We'll talk about tornadoes in just a moment. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Chad, I want to ask you about some commonly held weather beliefs, or as I like to say, things that my mother used to say when I was... How about... crickets chirps. Can you really tell if it's going to rain by a cricket's chirps?
In a way, crickets are probably better known as an outdoor thermometer more than anything. So when storm systems approach, you usually get a run up of temperatures and a cool down. And the crickets, when they are chirping faster, it's when it's warmer, and then they slow down when it's cold. A lot of that has to do with the fact that they don't have the, they're not like a mammal. They don't have the blood flow. So as a cricket chirps, gets slower, that means it's going to be colder. And when it's warmer, they chirp faster. And so there's kind of a little number way, like you can count lightning and you hear thunder, or excuse me, you see lightning, you hear thunder 10 seconds later. That kind of count, there's a way to do that with crickets too. And if I remember right, it's something about you count the number for, I think, 10 seconds, and then you have to add like 30 or 40 degrees to it, and that tells you what the temperature is outside.
That's crazy. But real. Okay. What about lightning? Does it strike the same place twice?
It can. So the biggest thing with lightning is that the human eye is, I make light of this, it's dumb, because the human eye makes it look like the lightning's actually going from the cloud to the ground, when it's actually, the lightning actually is, the particles are getting charged, and your ions are getting charged as the clouds scrape across the ground, but the lightning actually is coming from the ground up, and then the step leader comes from the cloud to meet it halfway up in the sky. But lightning can strike the same place twice. For those areas that want lightning to strike the same place, such as antennas for, WPR, for our news station, we always have lightning suppression. So you want it to hit certain areas. Those kind of are more of a lightning attractant. But lightning can hit the same place twice, but usually it's looking for the tallest point around the area to make that transfer of ions a less distance. So when I talk about lightning, and with any thunderstorm, lightning's always the biggest threat, because lightning strikes out ahead of storms several miles and can strike out behind it several miles. So that if someone says, "Oh, there's no severe weather, let's go outside," and it's like, "Well, no, there's still a thunderstorm there." The whole idea of a thunderstorm is thunder and lightning. Lightning is a direct killer. Not many people can survive lightning strikes. So that's one of our biggest concerns, is that even if we don't have a severe weather situation, we still have to mention, hey, there's thunderstorms out there from 4 to 6 o'clock. Don't be outside.
There's a famous phrase that the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil can set off a tornado in Texas. Is that really a thing? And what is this butterfly effect anyway?
Well, so the butterfly effect is really more so about chaos theory.
Okay.
And that's a theory that basically any little action in any capacity, it doesn't have to apply to weather, but in this case, weather. So the idea is that if a butterfly flaps its wings, at some point there's going to be an equal reaction to that in the atmosphere. So if the butterfly is flapping the wings, the wind is going out from it, and you're getting a wind behind it, so that eventually at some point that will propagate itself into a different storm system or a tornado. It's all based on chaos theory, which when you think of weather and forecasting, with how fluid things are and what you're trying to predict, it is kind of a theory that a lot of meteorologists subscribe to, but we don't necessarily quite believe it, because of our science and now with modeling that tells us a little different story. But it's really based on chaos theory, and the fact that a butterfly can flap its wings, a tornado happen. I guess it's plausible, but it's probably not likely.
Okay. In the Wausau area, a lot of people think, my husband says this all the time, he says that the city is protected from most tornadoes because of Rib Mountain. Like the Rib Mountain somehow protects the city from getting tornadoes that they either go that they go around us. Is there anything to that, or can I tell him he's wrong?
You can tell him he's wrong, because we actually had a tornado hit in the 70s.
I remember.
That came right down, came right down the mountain. And we have a perfect vantage point of the Rib Mountain from our studio right on the Wisconsin River. And our videographer that day that got all the video of this tornado, Dennis Dalsky, who just retired not that long ago, he told the story about that. Now, we saw the video, but it really just kind of came down the mountainside. And it did kind of hop, skip, and jump a little bit as it came across. And at that point, obviously, Rib Mountain wasn't built up the way it is now in 77. And then it moved out over the station. It kind of hopped off the river over our station and then went up East Hill outside toward town line going eastward.
Yep.
So the idea that mountains are protecting you, that's not true. There used to be a lot of thought when I was first in school, you were still hearing the theories about, oh, big cities don't get hit because the buildings break up the wind flow. And while I was in college, Nashville got hit. And then, oh yeah, Oklahoma City got half of that, you know, the northeastern corner got destroyed by a tornado. So those aren't true either. There was at one point a study about 20 years ago where they were actually studying in Kansas and Oklahoma. They were studying mobile home parks because they thought that those were some kind of a magnet for tornadoes to happen, because mobile homes obviously don't do well through any kind of a tornado event or any kind of a very strong wind event. So the National Weather Service actually spent some money studying it, and it's more so the fact that, again, mobile homes are more susceptible to damage because they're just not built the same way as a house. Also, in those parts of the country, you don't have basements. Almost everything's on a concrete slab.
The number to call, 800-780-9742. If you have weather questions for Chad, you're welcome to call us or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tornado season just about here. When is tornado season in Wisconsin, and how many do we typically see here in a year?
Well, so on average, Wisconsin sees 24 tornadoes in a season. For us, the sweet spot, so to speak, in our area of Wisconsin is usually that mid-June through mid-July. But that's always kind of a misnomer, because year to year, it could be a late season, it could be early. You think back to 2011, we had the April tornado that hit Merrill. And then sometimes you get a break in the season. But on average, the jet stream is set up enough to that mid-June through mid-July is kind of the sweet spot. And then farther south in the southern part of the state, you could say mid-June through the end of July.
So what creates the perfect storm, so to speak, when it comes to tornadoes? Is it heat, humidity? What makes the perfect conditions for that to happen?
All of the above. So if you're looking for a storm setup and a severe weather chase, and there are chasers in this area that do travel outside the state, what they're looking for is a big setup with a low pressure system, an active jet stream, several days of a strong warm front or warm front situation that is tapping into the Gulf moisture to bring in the higher humidities. And then we need that stark contrast, the clash of the air masses. We need a cold front with some drier weather coming in behind it right away. And then we also need some help from the jet stream to trigger to make things really pop, so to speak. So every severe weather situation, the setups are always different. They're similar in what they look like, but they're always different in how they act. So that's why the Storm Prediction Center puts out those outlooks. You're in this marginal risk, you're in this enhanced risk. And those are based off of the expected weather conditions as those kind of storm systems roll through. So for a storm chaser, you want, you know, at least a day, 2 days of a really windy, warm condition and a lot of humidity pushing into the area. And then we want a very strong cold front to not only bring in a quick drop in dew points, but you want that drop of temperatures, maybe 20 or 30 degrees, to get that really good, strong clash of the air mass type event.
When you are looking at radar and the conditions are right for a tornado, what do you look for specifically that says, uh-oh, this we've got something going on here? What are you looking for?
Yeah, so alluded to this a little bit at the beginning. It's what we're looking for really is a radar and a hook echo on the radar. That's the ideal situation. That's the textbook example. The problem we have here is a lot of central Wisconsin, we're still in that The radar beam is about 9,000 feet in the air, so we're still not quite seeing what's underneath it. So when we see Hook echoes on the radar here, you know, that gives us a good indication that we have a very strong updraft and downdraft. Now, every thunderstorm has an updraft and a downdraft. That's the definition of it. But when you're seeing the Hook echo, you're seeing a violently wrap and a violently rotating type situation. It's the rotational part that the radar is picking up on, and those at times can lead to tornadoes that usually develop just to the southwestern part of that Hook echo, because the radar beam is actually seeing the tilt of the storm and not directly on what's going below you. So case in point, last year we were on the air for 4 hours almost straight through, where there was a very strong thunderstorm that left Marshfield, and it was relayed to the Weather Service that it was a tornadic storm. And it really followed Highway 153 eastward for a couple hours. And so we were on the air with that, seeing the Hook echo, seeing that on radar. And again, we're not seeing the very bottom of the atmosphere. We're just seeing that on the radar. So we were under the impression, as it was relayed to the Weather Service, it was a tornado. We thought for sure there's a tornado on the ground. We did get one of our meteorologists down to Mosinee by the airport, and she was able to tell us that there was nothing coming down from that cloud in regards to a tornado. Those are those kind of situations. That's what we're looking for on radar. There are other parts of the radar and different products. Sometimes we show them on air with reflectivities and tornado debris signature stuff. But a lot of that we usually leave behind the scenes. It's when we're showing those type products, we don't have that ability to educate the public on what they're seeing. Mm-hmm. If someone's watching, they're watching the radar. If they're privy to weather, they know Hook echo is what they're kind of hearing for a tornado. If we start throwing a lot of other products on there, we don't get a chance to really kind of educate the public on what's going on. But if the velocity is showing something, we do put that on there and try to explain what that is.
Well, can you explain to me what a Hook echo actually is? I hear it a lot. I mean, when you were just talking about it, but what is it? What does it look like?
So it looks like a little kind of a comma C shape when the radar is hitting it. What you're detecting is the radar is detecting the particles and then basically timing the Doppler effect, how long it takes. And then it paints a color and a which we look at. So what we're looking at that point is you're looking for this kind of comma C shape thing, this kind of little hook. And you're looking for, in this part of the country, the east side did not have a whole lot of color to it. And then for the west side to have this brighter color, like a little circle. And that tells you that you've got a very strong updraft and downdraft, in this case, the downdraft that you're looking at. And so that Hook echo is usually not only the strong updraft and downdraft, but the downdraft part that extends underneath the cloud deck. And that's where a tornado would form on most storms.
You were talking about that tornado that went or that storm that went down 153. How far can tornadoes actually travel?
You know, that's the sad thing is Kentucky from last year was a great example of what a long track tornado can do. They can travel, you know, tens of miles, 100 miles. A lot of times when these tornadoes are long lived like this and long tracked, they have a tendency to skip up and down the landscape a little bit. So when you get those long track tornadoes, that's what they usually cause the most amount of damage. You know, so that's what you're really scared of when you're a meteorologist, is you see what's going on and you see that there is a possible tornado, and then you see how long it's going. And that's where, you know, you're going to have mass destruction. Some of the longest track tornadoes are, but again, a lot of times they have a tendency to skip up and down the landscape.
Chad, you're breaking up just you're breaking up just a little bit there. So I didn't catch that very last thing that you said. But I do want to ask you, too, how tornadoes are rated. We hear the F1, F2, what's the method there?
Sure. So the tornado scale is now an EF scale, an enhanced Fujita scale from Dr. Ted Fujita that started this long time ago. And the tornado scale is all based on the damage and the wind gusts that after it looks at damage. So what you're looking at when a National Weather Service goes out and does a site survey, they're actually looking at the damage and pictures of the damage, and then they come up with the scale and approximate wind that was associated with it. So an EF0 is usually a light, what they call light damage. You may maybe some shingles, branches, and then an EF5 is where you have a incredible devastating type damage where houses are stripped off foundations and you can have things that normally wouldn't happen. There was a case from about 15 years ago near Mosinee where a corn stalk had got caught in a tornado at that point, and that got thrown through a brick cinder block and it went through it. And it's because of what the tornado takes and throws at you at 200 miles an hour that causes the damage more so than anything else. So as I always tell kids, if a tornado happened in your gym and you're tied down and nothing could be thrown at you, you'd go through a windstorm and you would not know what's going on. But it's what it picks up and throws at you at 100 to 200 miles an hour, which is what's going to cause damage and injury. But for most of Wisconsin, most of our tornadoes are either EF0s or EF1s. There are some that have been rated EF3 and EF4s throughout the years as well.
We had a caller from Paul in Rib Mountain. He had a question for you. He wanted to ask you to discuss weather modification, chemtrails and weather modification. Is that true? Is there such a thing as weather modification by jets? Fact or fiction?
Well, when I hear weather modification, there are programs that are done for weather modification, but not in that kind of a capacity. When I hear weather modification, with the Weather Service and all the universities are really working on is trying to modify weather to, hail suppression, cloud seeding. That kind of weather modification is what I think of when I hear that. When it comes to chemtrails and the thought that there are chemtrails and that the government is doing this, that's beyond my level of science. I don't necessarily believe in that because we do know that when you have jets flying through the atmosphere, that's a superheated column of air that comes out what is a contrail. And for people that are on the other side, they say, well, it's a chemtrail and there's chemicals. Well, there sure is. I mean, your combustion engine up there, there is parts of that coming off, but it's not like they're chemically spraying to change anything. It's just, that's the byproduct of having a jet engine flying through the air in a different scale, but in the same process. You drive by Western Four Power Plant, you have clouds coming up from that. You have superheated air that's cooling. That's what happens. Clouds form. So I don't necessarily subscribe to the fact that there's weather modification to do anything detrimental to the country by chemtrails per se. But I also know that when you have byproducts of stuff going in the atmosphere, that isn't necessarily a good thing either. I just don't think that that's a concerted effort to do anything like that.
Thank you for addressing that. Chad Franzen is our guest today on Route 51 for a discussion on weather and backyard meteorology. Coming up, some great ways to predict the weather at home without the fancy computer modeling program. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Listener support makes everything you enjoy on WPR possible. We know you value Route 51 and all WPR programs. So make your contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Your gift is so important. Thank you. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guest today is WSAW-TV meteorologist Chad Franzen as we continue our program on backyard meteorology. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@WPR.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. So, Chad, how is climate change affecting us here in Wisconsin? Are we seeing more weather extremes than we used to?
You know, that's the biggest thing is when people talk about weather extremes, there's so many different aspects of it because there's so many different variables of weather. So when someone says, oh, the weather is more extreme today compared to, let's say, 40 years ago, what variable are you looking at? So that's always my biggest question. Is weather violent? Yes. Does there seem to be more violent weather going on? Possibly. But the other issue is that keep in mind what has changed over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years is you have this country in particular that has had a lot more population. You have a lot more population growth, and a lot of that growth is coming into suburbs that normally wouldn't be maybe necessarily affected by some part of the storm. So it does seem like the weather is getting a little more violent, sure. But it's hard to know because there's so many different variables. That it's the same thing that I would go ask someone, who's the best Packers quarterback ever? Is it Brett Favre or is it Aaron Rodgers or is it Dan Majkowski? And you have 5,000 different opinions because nobody knows what is your baseline for making that statement. So is the weather more violent than it used to be? Possibly. But we're also affecting a lot more people than we used to 20, 30, 40 years ago because of how much the country's population has changed in that amount of time. Does it mean it's going to get better or worse? It's hard to know. If the weather, the climate is certainly changing. Now, if the climate is changing at a slow rate, which is slow in this regard, is less than a degree Celsius in the last 100 years. So as that changes, things will change. You will eventually see parts of the country that look differently thousands of years from now because of, let's say, if it continues to warm up. You're going to have areas that are deserts that become lush. You're going to have areas, if it continues to warm up, you're going to have areas along the coast that are going to disappear into the water because the water levels will come up in the oceans. And then different parts of the country thousands of years down the road will look differently and act differently. So that's where it's evolving. In Wisconsin, the one thing that, from a numbers standpoint, that I can give you concrete numbers on, in Wisconsin, the climate record, the period of record that the National Weather Service and NCDC keeps, they change it every 30 years. They update it. So the 30-year period of record now is 1990 through 2020. That change, our average temperatures compared to the period of record 30 years before that, the average temperatures have climbed in most months within a half a degree, close to a degree in central Wisconsin. The other thing that it does is it has also changed our average amount of snowfall so that as the earth has warmed up a little bit in the last 30-year record, we have actually increased our average snowfall in the Wausau area by almost 4 inches. So when people talk about climate change, yeah, I believe it's happening. It's a question of what is all part of it. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, as the climate has changed, we have also changed 1,000 different things just in the last 100 years. We keep records differently in weather than we used to. There's no period of record for weather more than about 150 years ago. There's no data. There's no science. There's no written record of it. Some smaller places in some older places on the East Coast have some climate record. But if you said, what's the temperature of Denver from 1865? Let's say that was the first year it was a city. I think it was later than that. But if you said, what was the average temperature in Denver the first year it was founded? No one's got that. So now you have to go by the numbers, a direct measure in about the last 100 years. The other process of that is you have also taken thermometers that used to be alcohol-based. They're no longer alcohol-based because it evaporates. So even the measuring tool used for climate records for the last 100 years has changed. And then for a lot of these places, what we call ASOS or the thermometer sticks where we get the weather information from, most of them have been relocated into airports. And what does an airport usually have? Blacktop runway. So we know that that is going to inherently bring temperatures up because you have put it into an urban heat island situation. So there's always those factors of it. That doesn't mean that it's not happening. I'm just telling you that there's 1,000 different things going on. When someone says, oh, the there's change in 300 years. Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. But we don't have direct measure of temperatures 300 years ago. We have tree rings and satellites and some dating devices, but you don't have a direct number. You can't say, what was the temperature on this date in 1742? Mm-hmm. No one's got that number. So that's where the climate has changed. We're getting more and more thermometer stations. We have more data points. So we're getting better climate information. What this country and what other countries do with it moving forward and how that works is a different story.
Sure.
Because now you have kind of a 100 years of written record. You've seen what's happened the last 100. Now you can kind of see what's going to happen in the next 100.
Well, let's talk about how to make our own forecasts. Things have changed. A lot of things have changed, not just with how we measure the temperatures and how we keep records, but obviously you have some really sophisticated tools to help predict the weather. But if I don't have any of that, I don't want to look at an app. I don't want to look at my phone. I don't want to hear the forecast on TV. What are some things?
I don't want to hear you say that, Shireen.
Oh, come on
now. I
run
our app here at the station.
Let's say I don't have access to it for a day. Let's sure. say that. And I yeah. want to know what the weather's going to be like. What are some clues in nature that I should be looking for that can tell me maybe that some rain is on the way or how warm it's going to be? What do you look at?
Sure. So, you know, back in the day, especially when the country was expanding from the Appalachians westward, you know, you're talking Pony Express and Conestoga wagons and the settling came out west. So what happened over time, and farmers were the first to really notice this, is that even though they didn't have a way to phone anybody at that point, they knew that as they met with their neighbors, either on the west side or the east side of that vast expanse of real estate in the Louisiana Purchase, they knew that the weather downstream was coming from the west, and they could tell, and they eventually kind of developed their own method, which is still an easy kind of forecast tool today. So if, for instance, today we're in a low pressure system, so it's hard to know exactly the timing of the rain, but we do know because of all the clouds and the wind right now that with the wind out of the east southeast and all the clouds, we're eventually going to get some kind of rain. Behind it, when we get into a high pressure system, what ends up typically happening is as the next storm system approaches, you actually start seeing clouds moving in, and they start out way high, thin cirrus clouds that are really ice crystals. And then over the course of 12, 18, 24 hours, that cloud deck gets closer and closer to the ground. It also fills in, so you lose your sunshine, and then you know your next storm system approaching. Mm-hmm. So there are ways to kind of tell that. But if you don't have, if you're not familiar with the area, or if you're not really paying attention more so to a wind direction, it may be a little tougher. But it is one of those things that without technology, you can still kind of get a good baseline for it. The other thing is that the Weather Service data and everything that we use for forecasting 20 years ago used to cost money. Now with everybody's tax dollars, everything is free. So there are ways to go to various websites that aren't necessarily like a TV or radio station that would change it. There are ways to actually go get the modeling information yourself that's presented in a number format, what we call MOS, Model mm-hmm. Output Statistics. And that was something that I showed my parents and bookmarked on their computer when they lived in South Dakota, that instead of having to worry about calling me every day, they just go look at that and kind of had a baseline of what was going to happen.
All right, I'm going to ask you some more things that my mother used to say. Does a ring around the moon mean snow or rain is on the way?
Yes, in this capacity. So the ring around the moon is because you have all those ice crystals, the cirrus and the ice crystals coming out ahead of our next storm system. That's what's giving you the halo, is the actual, the visible part of that is the halo effect from the light scattering around the crystals around the moon. So that tells you more moisture is in the air when ice crystals start doing that. We get the same thing that happens in the summertime too, is if there's not a whole lot of humidity in the air, that ring may not be as pronounced. But if it's a warm, humid night and you hear all the crickets chirping and the frogs are going, you look up and you can see in the moon, there will be a huge part of that because of the halo effect, because of all the moisture that's pushed in. Now, when you're seeing the halo, keep in mind that is so far above the ground, but it all translates down to the ground eventually with the higher humidity values, starts high in the sky and works its way to the ground.
Okay. Red sky in the morning, sailors take warning. Red sky at night, sailors delight. True or false?
For the most part, that's pretty much true. I mean, that, it kind of depends on what part of the country you're in, but what that usually is when you're seeing the red sky in the morning, that's when you're talking about a storm system usually moving in west to east, and that's because of how the clouds will form and what you will see from sunrise to sunset. And then the red sky at night as the sun is setting, you're behind the cloud deck, and that's where you're getting the blocking from the thunderstorm clouds in between that and the sunset. So usually those are storm clouds, and so therefore, again, sailor's delight. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things, it does work a little bit like that, but for the most part, it's probably one of those monikers that's better noted for someone if they actually have to be out in the water sure. as opposed to like a storm chaser.
Okay, and this is the weirdest one. If cats wash behind their ears, it's going to rain. Apparently, yeah, they just know.
So I have a lot of coworkers that have cats, and I'm a dog person, so I have two dogs, and I always say dogs are better than cats. But they bring up to me that a cat can predict the weather. So the whole premise is that when they wash behind their ears of the expecting of the rain, it's really more so the fact that they're cleaning before the rain actually comes in. There's also a part where they talk about usually in like January, February, where you get a lot of sun, they lay in the sun. But if they go back and start kind of working their way and start laying more so by like a source of your heat, like in by a register in March, that tells you that a cool front or a cool down is on the way. So it's kind of one of those loose interpretations. All these weather folklore things are, you know, they're never a concrete 100%. Same thing with the hardcore science of a hook echo on radar doesn't mean there's a tornado. It's just one of those kind of things to know. You know, my bigger thing is that, you know, if you can hear thunder, you know, lightning's part of it. So that's always been my bigger thing because that's a more dangerous situation. But there's weather folklore. When the caterpillars get the more fuzziness, mm-hmm. that it's expected to have a worse winter. I've seen that kind of more 50-50 here in the state of Wisconsin. You also have the fact that when the let's say, for instance, deer, when their hides start getting a little thicker, that tells you that maybe a stronger winter is coming. So those are all kind of those things along the weather folklore. But again, it's kind of a hard thing to say 100% it's happening. Same thing when people talk about an Indian summer. What defines an Indian summer? Well, it's usually a stretch of 70s after the first frost. Well, if we don't have a frost, is it technically an Indian summer of 8 days in the 70s or is it not? Mm-hmm. So weather folklore is one of those things. It's not one that you can 100% usually debunk. It's not one that's going to be 100% correct, but there is some truth in that. And there's a reason why it's folklore, because it has been told from generation to generation, because it has some truth aspect to it.
Well, let's talk about the weather, this coming weather that we're going to expect. What's your prediction for the summer this year, whether you're looking at caterpillars or not? Is it ever going to warm up? I mean, what kind of weather do you think we're going to see this summer?
So we talked about earlier in the show with fact that we're in this kind of stuck pattern where we haven't made the North Atlantic Oscillation change yet from its phase of a typical winter phase into more of a typical summer phase. So right now we're really stuck in this negative mode of the jet stream than the North Atlantic Oscillation, which is more of a winter one. So eventually we will switch over to the spring one. And once that happens, things will warm up drastically in the next several weeks. But until that time, it's really hard to know. I think that summer, when it does get here, is going to be probably a pretty nice one, because now we're in between two different things. We just came out of El Nino, and we're not to La Nina. So you have a really kind of a typical summer setup on the jet stream setting up, which is our long-term weather pattern. And so I think on the whole, we'll probably have a pretty average summer where we have some wet times, we have some cool times, but on the overall average, once it's done, I think we'll be in what would be considered kind of a normal summertime.
Is the Farmer's Almanac reliable? A lot of people go by that.
Yeah, you know, and I always look at it. The National Weather Service puts out their forecast for an extended period of time, Farmer's Almanac, and then also Weather Bell does their own too. The one thing about the Farmer's Almanac is they have their secret method of doing this that they don't release to anybody. And part of their theory is they're looking at some solar lunar tables. They're looking at a lot of things. Sometimes if there's a significant astronomical event, that kind of gets into their forecast. But the one thing the Farmer's Almanac for the last 4 years now has always predicted in this part of the country, on the average, once it's done, a colder than and a snowier than normal winter. In the last 4 years, we haven't seen both of that pan out in any one of those four. Mm-hmm. 1 year we had snowier than normal. In 2018, we got dumped on a lot, but the temperature overall was pretty mild. So that's why it's like, yes, read those things, but keep in mind weather prediction, even after 7 days, is a tough thing to do.
All right, 30 seconds left, and you know I have to ask you this. How come you're wrong sometimes? You have all those fancy things. How, like all these great computer models, how come you're wrong sometimes?
You know, and that's the one thing that I will say that the computer modeling has gotten better on, but the dissemination of it to people has not. I think that when we get things wrong, the things that would be necessarily not correct would be like snow forecast and amounts there. But keep in mind, when we're forecasting for 20 counties, and we all know that the Northwoods snowfall is going to be a lot different from our friends down in Juneau and Adams counties.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for all you do. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending a sincere thanks to our guest, WSAW-TV meteorologist Chad Franzen. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Joy is our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program as well as our previous programs at WPR.org/Route 51. Please show your support of Route 51 and all WPR programs during our spring member drive with your contribution of any amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thank you. Until next week, we're heading out of town.